Hello and welcome to LSTM's podcast series, where we meet some of the most curious minds in science. I'm Lee Bowman, and today we welcome Jenna Gritzfeld, a research assistant and PhD student, who will be discussing her work on the human pneumococcal carriage model, and Dr. Alvaro Acosta Serrano, who will be describing host-parasite interactions and how his group's recent publications contribute to a greater understanding of the neglected tropical disease trypanosomiasis. First up, we have Chris Spencer and Jenna Gritzfeld.
Hi, I'm here today with Jenna Gritzfeld, who works in the respiratory infection group here at LSTM and has done since her MSc project. She now works with the group as a research assistant, and alongside that, she's working on her PhD. So, Jenna, hi.
Good morning.
So, you've helped to develop the experimental human pneumococcal carriage model. Can you just explain what that model is?
Yeah, sure. Streptococcus pneumoniae is the cause of disease such as otitis media, which is ear infection, pneumonia, meningitis, and bacteremia. And interestingly, it kills more children than AIDS, malaria, and measles combined. But in order for any disease to occur, the bacteria must first exist within the nasopharynx, and this is what we call the carriage state. From this spot in the nose, in some individuals, the bugs can be transmitted to other parts of the body where they will cause disease. Now, disease only occurs in a small percentage of the population, whereas up to 90% of children and 10% of adults can carry pneumococci at any time and remain healthy. So the question is, why do some people get carriage and remain healthy and some people get disease? We're not sure. So we have developed an experimental human pneumococcal carriage model in order to study the carriage state in the natural host of the pneumococcus, which is the human. So we recruit healthy adult volunteers and we take baseline samples, things including a nasal wash, serum, saliva, and urine. And then we actually put the pneumococcus in the nose of the volunteer. And we do nasal washes 2, 7, and 14 days after this in order to try and determine if the person has developed carriage. We can then use all these samples to compare the immune response before and after challenge, and we can look at how the microbial flora of the nasopharynx is altered by the pneumococcus. One of the big things we're trying to do with this model at the moment is to use it as a tool for vaccine development.
So what kind of results have you gotten out of using this model so far?
Well, we began with a number of preliminary studies just to try and get our technique right. And then the first main thing we did was a dose ranging study, which we used to try and determine at what dose we could achieve a 50% carriage rate in a group of people. So there are more than 90 known pneumococcal serotypes, and these all vary in their ability to cause disease. So we chose two serotypes which have been shown to be prevalent in carriage, and these were both clinical isolates, and they are 6B and 23F. And with the 6B, we were able to achieve 50% carriage at a dose of 80,000 colony-forming units. Now, surprisingly, that we could not get the 23F to work. So this is something I'm examining as part of my PhD thesis, and I'm trying to determine what the difference is between these two bugs, why one will work and one won't in the model. In terms of further experiments with the 6B, we then did a reproducibility study, which confirmed that we could actually replicate that 50% carriage result at a dose of 80,000, so we could go forward with that dose in future studies. Another bit of my PhD is to examine the innate immune response in these individuals after they've been challenged with the bacteria, and so far I've looked at three different innate immune molecules that are found in the mucosa, and none of the levels of these molecules are predictive of carriage, nor do they change when someone is actually carrying the bug. And we have two postdocs in the lab who have looked at different parts of the immune response. Dr. Daniela Ferreira has looked at the antibody responses and found that carriage increases both mucosal and serum IgG levels to pneumococcal proteins and polysaccharide. And Dr. Adam Wright, who has now moved on to Leicester, was able to demonstrate that carriage can increase the proportion of lung IL-17A secreting CD4 memory T cells, and these may enhance innate cellular immunity against pathogenic challenge.
So as I understand it, carriage models aren't really used in many other vaccine trials, so why are they so important for pneumococci?
Well, there are currently two types of vaccines on the market against the pneumococcus. The first, the polysaccharide vaccine, targets 23 different serotypes and is licensed for use in adults. However, its effectiveness in protection against pneumonia and IPD is very controversial and inconclusive. Now, the good vaccine on the market at the moment is the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, and this has a number of different types made by different companies, and the difference between them is that they target different numbers of serotypes. So the most common one at the moment is the PCV13, which targets 13 serotypes. This is licensed for use in children all over the world and is part of many young immunization programs, and it's actually licensed for use in adults over the age of 50 in the US as well. Now, all these PCV vaccines have been very successful in protecting against invasive pneumococcal disease, but they all share two clinical drawbacks. The first is that they only cover a very small number of serotypes. When there's over 90 and you're only covering 13, that's not very many. And the prevalence of these serotypes does vary geographically. The main causes of disease in Africa differ from the main causes of disease in America. And secondly, as vaccination tends to decrease the vaccine type pneumococci, the space where these were is now being filled with non-vaccine type pneumococci, something known as serotype replacement. And in certain members of the population, we are seeing increases in disease with these non-vaccine type pneumococci. So these two problems, combined with the fact that PCV is very complex and expensive to manufacture, means that an affordable vaccine that could confer broad protection against pneumococcal disease is a major priority. The problem being, having a vaccine that works is now making it very difficult to trial a new vaccine, because using disease as an endpoint, you're going to need to give a placebo, and that's no longer ethical. So if you wanted to compare the current PCV vaccines to any new potential vaccine, you would probably need hundreds of thousands of person's years of observation to come up with a result. So that's where we think carriage could be really useful. And the experimental human pneumococcal carriage model could provide an endpoint for early vaccine testing. So we're currently running a double-blind randomized control trial using this PCV13 vaccine and comparing it with a control vaccine. We're using hepatitis A. And we're looking to see what impact PCV13 is having on carriage in the healthy adult population here in the UK. There are only 3 weeks left in this trial, at which point we will be able to unblind ourselves and find out if it has actually made an impact, and then we can go forward with those results.
Now, you're about to use your model to trial a new vaccine. Do you mind if we talk a little about that?
Yeah, so the current testing we're doing with the PCV13 vaccine was kind of a way to test if this was going to work with future vaccines that would be on the market. So we are going to do a phase 2 double-blind randomized control trial using a candidate vaccine from Genosha Biosciences, which is a vaccine development company in the US. They currently have their vaccine in phase 1 trials, and they've designed it so that it can protect against all serotypes by using something completely different than the previous vaccines, and that's a novel T-cell mediated mechanism. So there has been a number of publications that show that Th17 responses are a natural mechanism to clear pneumococci from the nasopharynx. And Genosha's three unique protein antigens have shown in early preclinical studies that they can reduce colonization as well. So by trialing this vaccine in our model, we're hoping that we can not only evaluate the efficacy of it, but look to see if it actually will reduce colonization in a healthy adult population.
Well, I hope the trial goes well, and best of luck with the rest of the PhD. Thank you very much, Jenna.
Thank you.
Thank you to both Chris and Jenna for the interview. Now we go to Kayla Barnes, who is speaking with Dr. Alvaro Acosta Serrano.
Today I'm speaking with Dr. Alvaro Acosta Serrano, a lecturer in both the departments of vector biology and parasitology. Alvaro researches the host-parasite interaction. Alvaro, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kayla.
Alvaro, you research a few different things. Can you just give us a little bit more information about your interest in the vector-parasite interaction?
Yeah, so I have a long history working with trypanosomes, mainly trypanosomes causing an important disease in Africa known as sleeping sickness. So we have a very fundamental, a basic program trying to understand how trypanosomes are transmitted by the insect vector, which is known as tsetsefly. And we apply different techniques to understand how the parasite interacts, undergoes a cycle inside the fly, and then gets transmitted to the next vertebrate host. So we apply fundamental biochemistry, genetics, and cell biology to answer some of these questions that are fascinating from the biology point of view, but also may bring new opportunities to stop transmission and impact of these diseases.
Very interesting. And Alvaro, you were recently part of a big publication in Science that looked at the genome sequence of the tsetsefly. Can you just give us a little bit more information about that and why a genome sequence is so important?
Yes, well, we can look at two different ways. So from the biology point of view, tsetseflies are really fascinating. So although this is only one species that has been sequenced, there are many, many species of tsetseflies in sub-Saharan Africa. They have different habits, they have different targets, they live in different conditions. So that also, what I mean is that these investigations will lead us to understand at the genetic level some of the difference in behavior of the all these tsetseflies. The other aspect that is fascinating in the biology is that tsetseflies are viviparous. They don't lay eggs. They give birth to larvae that goes into pupation in soil. And that larvae lives in utero, and that makes the mother, the female fly, to produce, have a specialized organs that are literally milk glands where that larvae feeds on. That's very rare and unique. And so it's not only fascinating, but also it represents maybe a target for eliminating tsetseflies that are medically or veterinarily important. The other important aspect, obviously, of this publication is regarding the disease tsetsefly transmit. And they are vectors for trypanosomiasis. Trypanosomiasis still affect many million people in sub-Saharan Africa that are at risk to contract the disease. There is no vaccine to prevent trypanosomiasis. The current drugs are very strong. So the knowledge of the genome will offer an opportunity to the design of new waves to control tsetse in the endemic areas.
So a paper that you also published with your PhD student, Claire Rose, touched on some of the work that went into this and some of the specific fundamental biology of the tsetsefly, dealing with the protein composition of the peritrophic matrix. So why is the peritrophic matrix so important, and how did you go about defining these proteins?
Yeah, so this is part of the project that we're still working in the lab. And the main question is this. So trypanosomes, when a tsetsefly takes an infected blood meal from from a vertebrate, all these trypanosomes are the first land in the intestine of the fly. So what happened next is that these trypanosomes, they need to cross some of the tissues. One of the tissues they need to cross is known as peritrophic matrix. So the understanding of this, this is a little bit complex to describe, but it's like a bag inside the intestine. So what it does normally, the peritrophic matrix, is to compartmentalize the blood that is taken by the fly and leave it far away in contact with epithelial cells. Why? Because obviously some of the products from blood may be harmful for the fly, including making a barrier for pathogens. So one of the challenges that trypanosomes have in the mucus is to cross this tissue in order to colonize the intestine. So the reason why we published work, we're doing this research on the peritrophic matrix, is to try to understand at the molecular level how it happens. If we find, for example, some specific molecules from the parasite or the fly that are involved in any receptor ligand sort of a process, then we can think about maybe developing tools to prevent that interaction and to prevent or to block transmission at the early stages.
Very cool. So this could be used as both a diagnostic tool and maybe also as a technique to stopping sleeping sickness.
Absolutely.
Great. So with this genome and now this better understanding of the protein composition, you have a ton of work. What are you guys doing next, or what's some of the projects that you have coming up?
Well, now we have access. I mean, the genome is not fully annotated, so we're still trying to identify all the gene families that are specifically expressed in different organs and tissues, okay, and especially those that may be relevant to the trypanosome cycle in the fly. So we are interested in understanding, for example, what are the molecules from the parasite that are important for migration to different compartments. So, for example, after having a developmental cycle in the intestine, the parasite have to migrate to the salivary glands of the fly. So how this process occurs, and then the salivary gland, what happens in these tissues that then makes the parasite become an infectious form and therefore continue with disease transmission. Another aspect of this is to, looking at the other side of the coin, is to understand what genes from the tsetse fly are important or are related in fighting the trypanosome infection in the fly. And what happened is that not all the time that a fly takes an infected blood meal, it actually becomes infected with trypanosomes. In reality, most of the tsetse flies, they are highly resistant to develop an infection. So if we understand what the genes are involved in making a tsetse fly resistant to a trypanosome infection, we can maybe try to design transgenic, for example, bacteria that will live inside the tsetse flies and that will release specific factors that will be lethal for trypanosomes. So we're thinking about in a very long term, and something that is very difficult to accomplish from the technical point of view. But that would be some sort of a potential outcome of this knowledge.
So using a symbiotic relationship to maybe kill this parasite in the tsetse.
That's right. I mean, this is being attempted by other groups. It is it's potentially feasible to do. Obviously, then the challenge is to create flies that will harbor these transgenic bacteria for a long time, and then we'll be able to compete with wild-type bacteria in endemic areas. So obviously this is a long process, but it's the best we can do using these technologies, because we are completely unable to make transgenic or refractory sepsis flies like it's been done in, for example, with mosquitoes.
Very fascinating work, Alvaro. Thank you. If you'd like more information about Alvaro's work, you can visit his staff profile at the LSTM website. And if you would like to read either of these papers, you can find the genome sequence of the tsetse fly in the April edition of Science. And you can find Claire Rose's paper in PLOS Neglected Tropical Diseases, also in the April edition. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Kayla and Dr. Acosta Serrano for the interview. Well, that's all for this month. Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the interviews and will join us again for the June podcast, brought to you by the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.